was now. A spark of that youthful flame yet remained in his eyes, but dampened by bitterness and regret. "The Civil War was very hard on our generation, Cicero. There aren't many of us wise elders left. You and I are lucky to still be alive. All the more reason you might think these younger men would be eager to seek my advice and take advantage of my experience. Yet you sense that something is going on behind your back. Is it that you think there's a plot against Caesar and you feel left out?" I said. "Of course not." He spoke a bit too quickly. "Or is it that you suspect such a plot and you wish to stop it?" He began to answer, then caught himself and exchanged a guarded look with Dairo. He spoke slowly and carefully. "If there were such a plot, one might wish to thwart it, not just to save Caesar, but also to save the conspirators from themselves. That is, if one believed that the murder of Caesar would serve only to open yet another Pandora's box of chaos." "And is that what you believe, Cicero? That Rome is better off with Caesar alive than with Caesar dead?" He spoke even more cautiously. "Caesar has been voted dictator for the duration of his lifetime, by a Roman Senate packed with men chosen by Caesar himself. In a matter of days he'll meet with the Senate to make some final appointments and ratify some last bits of pending legislation, and then he'll join his troops and head for Parthia. Perhaps he'll rendezvous with Queen Cleopatra in Egypt on the way. Caesar will need the grain of the Nile to feed his army. And then, but who knows what will happen to Caesar in the months and years to come? Crassus staged the last Roman invasion of Parthia. His legions were annihilated, and his head ended up as a stage prop for a king. Of course, Caesar is 100 times the military leader Crassus was. No one doubts that he'll have his way with the Parthians. But once he's conquered Parthia, repeating the success of Alexander the Great, like Alexander, he may find it necessary to stay in that part of the world to govern it. Caesar may never come back to Rome. Alexander might have returned to Macedon had he not died suddenly so far from home. Caesar, too, some day will die. Is that the counsel you'd give to any hotheads who'd like to see Caesar dead and out of the way, to patiently await their turn, because every man dies sooner or later? No wonder the young blood see you off to bed before they get down to business. This was so harsh that even Davis furrowed his brow and frowned at me. If I spoke out of turn, it was because Cicero had touched a nerve. Where Caesar went, so too would Mito go. If Caesar never came back, I might never see my son again. Apologies, Cicero. You're absolutely right that the younger generation of senators should be looking to you for insight and inspiration. You're a survivor, if nothing else. Cicero is much more than that, said Tyro, rising to his old master's defence. He saved the state once, when he was consul and put down Catilina's insurrection. He may just save the state again, if given the chance. I drew a deep breath. So that was it. Cicero thought he might yet become the saviour of the Roman Republic. The puttering, even pathetic old scholar was just a pose. Cicero aspired to write the next chapter of Roman history, and thought himself capable of doing so, if only other Romans would look to him for leadership. "What is it you want from me?" I said quietly. "Only this, Gordianus, that you put your ear to the ground and share with me through Tyro any rumblings you might hear. You're so good at that sort of thing, making sense of rumours, knowing whom and what to ask, seeing what others fail to see. Think of the occasions when you and I worked together over the years. Remember our first collaboration, when we tweaked the nose of the dictator Sulla? If those memories mean anything to you, all I ask is that you share with me any information you come across regarding any plot to do away with the dictator. What I do with that information will be my own business, leaving you blameless, if I should take a misstep. Once Caesar leaves Rome, the situation will change completely, and I'll ask no more of you after that."
"We're talking about a matter of days, Gordianus," said Tyro.
"Why you think I might know anything of importance?" I shook my head.
"You have a way of acquiring other people's secrets without even trying," said Cicero, "rather like the iron of magnesia that attracts other bits of metal to itself."
"Exactly so," agreed Tyro, who reached for a stylus and tablet to jot down the comparison. "Would it be filed with other items about me for inclusion in the memoirs Cicero planned to write some day?" I looked at Davis, seeking silent solace in his bovine features, but he seemed to think my glance required a comment. He cleared his throat.
"They're right, you know. Some days, whether you like it or not, you're covered all over from head to feet with other people's secrets."
I tried to picture such an image and failed. What, after all, do secrets look like? But I knew exactly what the three of them meant. Sometimes I sought out secrets, but at other times, very often, they came to me unbidden. "Such was the blessing the gods gave me," I said quietly. "Sometimes the curse."
Chapter 5.
I took my leave of Cicero, with no agreement to see him again, much less report to him. Probably he thought otherwise, having endless faith in his powers of persuasion. It was hard for Cicero to hear the word no. As Davis and I strolled toward my house, a thought struck me. Might Cicero himself be part of some plot against Caesar? If that were the case, his questioning of me might have been aimed at discovering what Caesar himself knew or suspected, information I might have learned from Mito. That Cicero could be so conniving, I had no doubt, but that he was part of a plot to kill Caesar, I couldn't credit. To murder in cold blood was not Cicero's way. This wasn't to say he was squeamish. When he was consul, he had put Catilina's supporters to death without blinking an eye, and even boasted of it, behaviour that led to his temporary exile. But those had been executions carried out by the state. Legality made all the difference to Cicero, who lived and breathed Roman law. If Caesar could be put on trial and condemned to exile or death by legal means, then Cicero might enthusiastically take part. Any number of Caesar's actions since crossing the Rubicon might be construed as capital offences against the state. But to kill the man without legal sanction, no, I couldn't see Cicero taking part in any clandestine scheme.
That meant he was genuinely in the dark about such activity, if in fact it was happening. He didn't like feeling uncertain and excluded, and to inform himself, he had called on me. Cicero wasn't merely curious, he was alarmed. His political instincts had become unreliable in recent years, but they still counted for something. If Cicero was alarmed, should I be also? And should I convey the details of our encounter to Mito, who might then convey them to Caesar? Davis and I rounded a corner and my house came into view. An expensive-looking litter with expensive-looking bearers was stationed in front of my door. Expensive, but not ostentatious. The wooden poles were beautifully carved with a leafy pattern, but not painted or gilded, and while the curtains appeared to be of silk, they were a sombre greyish-green colour, without tassels or other gewgaws. They were also drawn back, so that I could see that the compartment, strewn with silk cushions of the same sombre colour, was empty. The visitor must be inside my house. I had already received one unexpected caller that morning. I wasn't looking forward to another. "An old man deserves a bit of peace and quiet," I muttered to myself. Davis overheard and nodded in agreement. The bearers were dressed in identical loose-fitting tunics of a colour similar to the curtains, but made of linen, not silk. The one in charge glanced at me as I approached my front door, appraised my status, then lowered his eyes. They were all big fellows, bigger even than Davis, and looked quite capable of acting as bodyguards as well as bearers. The fact that their leader took careful notice of an approaching citizen and then averted his gaze meant that they were exceptionally well-trained. How many surly, ill-tempered bodyguards owned by other men had I endured over the years, even though I was a citizen and they were slaves? I knocked at the door. The slave whose job it was to peek at visitors through a narrow opening did so, then hurriedly allowed me in. Diana appeared in the atrium, looking radiant under the slanting column of sunshine from the skylight above. "Papa, you'll never guess who's here." "I had no idea until this moment, but from the look on your face, I think it must be Mito."
"Right you are, Papa."
Mito stepped into the sunshine beside his sister. Though they shared no kinship by blood, to my eyes they looked much alike and equally beautiful. Mito, not quite 35, still had a boyish smile. He was dressed not in military garb, but in a toga. While I gave him a warm embrace, I saw from the corner of my eye that Diana was greeting Davis with a kiss that was anything but perfunctory. "How curious that you should pay us a visit," I said to Mito. "I was just thinking about you."
"Good thoughts, I hope?"
"Better thoughts than most I've had this morning."
"Diana says Tyro called on you and dragged you off to Cicero's house."
"Yes. What can that broken stylus want from you?" "Oh, you might be surprised."
"Or not," said Diana, speaking from Davis's encircling arms. "Oh, Papa, the look on your face. Don't worry, I kept my mouth shut. I know it's your business, not mine, to inform Mito about your dealings. I told him where you'd gone and said no more. You men are so touchy about such things."
"So true, daughter," said another voice, a bit deeper than Diana's, but of the same timbre. "A woman must never spoil a bit of gossip before a man can deliver it himself." "Good morning, wife," I said, stepping to Bethesda and giving her a kiss, more modest than that exchanged by Davis and my daughter.
I let you sleep late. You look all the lovelier for it. She squared her shoulders, ran her fingers through her silver and black tresses, and made a quiet snort. You thought I was asleep when you came home last night, and when you rose this morning, but I wasn't. You came home inebriated, and you woke with a terrible headache. I heard you groaning. Bethesda, must you reprimand me in front of my children? If I don't do it, who will? I sighed. Shouldn't you be in the kitchen, wife, telling the cook what to fix for our midday meal? We'll need an extra portion for Mito. Perhaps a double portion, I said, looking at him. It seemed to me that he was at the very peak of manhood, bursting with vitality, an ideal warrior to head off to Parthia with Caesar. The thought filled me with both pride and dread. I'm afraid I can't stay to eat, he said. Nor can you, Papa. Why not? Even as I spoke, I knew the answer. Mito would never have arrived in a litter like the one outside my door if he had simply come to pay a visit. It was a sort of conveyance, comfortable yet discreet, that a powerful man like the dictator would send to bring someone to his presence. Mito saw the comprehension on my face and nodded. What in Hades can Caesar want with me? I shook my head. Cicero and Caesar in one day, and while recovering from a vicious hangover, I don't think I can manage it. Bethesda pursed her lips. The hangover is entirely your own fault, and you will certainly not decline an invitation to see the dictator. Since my elevation to equestrian status, my wife had become increasingly conscious of her own new social rank and that of our children. She and Diana seemed always busy with preparations for some festival, mingling with other matrons of their newly achieved class. I was rather surprised and pleased at how readily the other Roman matrons seemed to accept Bethesda, considering that she had been born a slave and abroad in Egypt, and had become a free woman only through marriage with me, a Roman of humble origins. But many things in Rome surprised me these days. Times had changed. Many who had been at the pinnacle had fallen into the abyss, and many, like my wife, who had begun life at the very bottom, now found themselves, if not at the top, then allowed on occasion to rub elbows with those who were. "Don't you have some function to go to today?" I said irritably. "As a matter of fact, Mother," said Diana, "don't forget that we have a meeting at the Temple of Vesta to talk about planning for the festival of Anna Perenna on the Ides. Oh, and there's a gathering right after that at Fulvia's house to talk about the Liberalia. So much is happening in the next few days." "You're going to Mark Antony's house?" I said. Though our meetings over the years had been amicable, I hadn't seen the dictator's right-hand man in many months, not since he'd abandoned his scandalous affair with the actress Cytheris and married the most ambitious widow in Rome. The joke went that the only reason Fulvia hadn't married Caesar was that he already had one wife too many, meaning both Calpurnia and Queen Cleopatra. Fulvia, twice the widow of rising politicians struck down in their prime, had now settled on Antony. I smiled. If you think your husband drinks too much, imagine being married to Antony. On the contrary, said Bethesda, Fulvia has pulled him into shape quite nicely. He hardly drinks at all, takes vigorous exercise every day, stays out of trouble, and is firmly back in Caesar's good graces. If only women could be generals,
then Antony could stay at home while his wife goes out to conquer something.
You joke, husband, but Fulvia is a marvel at organizing things. There's no task too challenging. No detail, large or small, escapes her. Truly, the woman is a wonder. Mark Antony is very lucky to have finally found a wife who appreciates his talents and is determined to see him make the most of them.
As she continued to extol the virtues of Fulvia, my thoughts wandered. Might it be that Caesar wanted to see me for the same reason as had Cicero? To find out if I knew anything, or could discover anything, about any danger that might loom in the remaining days before he left Rome? What sort of predicament might arise should I find myself pulled between them? How simpler my life would be if other men would leave me alone. "What does Caesar want?" I asked Mito.
"A golden throne," he said with a straight face. "Oh, you mean with you, Papa? Quite honestly, I don't know, though I have a suspicion."
"Share it, then."
"I'd rather not, in case I'm wrong."
"Oh, come now, Mito, speak."
"Papa, really, I'd rather not."
A shadow flitted across his smiling face, and I was reminded, as perhaps he was, of a time in the past when we had been sadly estranged. His loyalty to Caesar had come between us. At least, that was my way of explaining the trouble. Whatever the cause, I never wanted such a gulf to open between us again. "Very well, then. I shall go to see the dictator and find out for myself what he wants from me. You'll be coming too, I hope."
"Of course, Papa. We can talk on the way and catch up on family news. I'd love to know how Eco and his brood have been faring since they moved down to Neapolis. Is it true that he and Meninia are living in a villa twice the size of this house?"
Paid for, I thought, by a small portion of the same windfall that landed me in the equestrian class. "Their house is quite modest compared to all the luxurious estates surrounding them on the Cup," I said, using the name locals preferred for the Bay of Neapolis. "Your brother is doing very well. Plenty of work for a finder," he says. "Adultery and murder and backstabbing among the old rich, or what's left of them. Even worse behavior among the new rich, who've moved into all those villas left vacant by senators who died in the war."
"And Eco took Rupert with him?"
"Mute Rupa, a blonde Sarmatian, was the youngest of my three adopted sons, and the brawniest. Well, we didn't need two such big fellows here in Rome, did we?" I nodded toward my son-in-law. "I could hardly afford to feed both. Rupa serves as a bodyguard for Eco, as Davis does for me."
"If only Caesar was as concerned about bodyguards," said Mito. "And Mopsus and Androcles, they're down in Neapolis as well."
"Those two, too loud and rowdy for the household of an old fellow with delicate nerves like myself," I said, though, in fact, I often missed the two slave boys. "They serve as Eco's messengers and errand runners, as they once served me. As I say, he's very busy. The Cup practically brims with crime."
"Not like Rome, then," said Mito. "With Caesar in charge, there's much less crime than there used to be, don't you think?"
"Less crime of the sort perpetrated by one rich man against another, yes. With Caesar watching, the powerful mind their manners. But there's more crime of the petty sort, I think. Crimes of the poor against the poor. The war left a lot of broken men in Rome, maimed in body or mind or both. Broken women, too. Desperate people resort to desperate measures. Thievery, threats, violence, murder. That's what I hear, anyway. during my evenings down at the salacious tavern? Mito frowned.
Mother tells me you're down there quite often these days, drinking more than you used to.
It passes the time. But the dictator awaits. Should I take Davis with me?
No need. Caesar's litter-bearers will see you safely home.
Then, as soon as I can change into my toga, let's be off.
Chapter 6.
Mistakenly, I had assumed that the litter-bearers would take us to Caesar's official residence in the city where he lived with Calpurnia, called the Regia, only a short trip from my house. When the bearers turned in the opposite direction, I shot a questioning look at Mito seated on the cushions opposite me.
"We're headed out of the city to the garden estate across the Tiber," he explained. "The trip will give us plenty of time to talk. You've been there before, haven't you?"
"As a matter of fact, I dropped in on the Queen when she was last here in Rome, when Caesar was staging his four triumphs."
"Ah, yes, and now Cleopatra is in residence there once again."
"With her son, I hear, or should I say their son?"
Mito smiled.
"As you well know, Papa, there is reality, and then there is official reality."
"And to which category does Caesar's paternity of Caesarion belong?"
"That matter," he said carefully, "may be in flux."
"How vexing it must be having to deal with two realities. Navigating one is challenging enough for me. I didn't think you much cared for the Egyptian queen."
"My feelings toward her have mellowed, as have hers toward me, I think."
"The boy must be about 4 years old now, speaking much?"
"Oh, yes. He inherited his mother's gift for languages. She has him reciting nursery rhymes in both Greek and Latin, probably in Egyptian as well."
"And how does the little boy address Caesar? As dictator?"
"Papa, you're incorrigible. In private, he addresses Caesar as I address you, but not in public. I don't think Caesar and Caesarion have ever been seen together in public, at least not in Rome. Perhaps when we visit Egypt on the way to Parthia to work out supply lines for the legions, that might change."
"The Queen has some public ceremony in mind. There's a rumour that Caesar intends to marry her, make himself King of Egypt, and name Caesarion as his royal heir."
"I can't speak for the Queen on that matter, nor for Caesar."
"But Caesar is residing at the garden estate along with Cleopatra?"
"Certainly not. That would set endless tongues wagging. Caesar visits the estate only during the day. He spends his nights with Calpurnia at the Regia."
"There's plenty that can be done by daylight that could cause tongues to wag," I thought. I looked at Mito and realized how glad I was for this unexpected little journey, which allowed me to spend some precious, rare time alone with him. Soon he would be leaving Rome again, off to war. What a worry he was to me, my warrior son. How many more chances would I have to see him? I had long feared for his life, but now I feared another mortality, my own. Whichever of us was to die first, the passing of time made it more and more likely that every moment spent together might be our last. We descended the Palatine and passed through the Roman Forum, where a religious procession of some sort interrupted our progress. Then the bearers skilfully threaded their way through the bustling marketplace in the Forum Borarium. We crossed the nearby bridge and found ourselves at once in the countryside, or at least a well-tended version of it. We passed by the Grove of the Furies, and then by the public meadows along the riverbank, where a handful of strollers were enjoying the lukewarm, marshes sunshine. A bit further on, the road veered away from the river and then ran parallel to it, giving access to the sumptuous private estates that fronted the most desirable stretch of the Tiber. Here, the wealthy of Rome had their second homes outside the city, where they could relax in lavish gardens, pursue fashionable hobbies like beekeeping, and in summer go boating and swimming in the river. From the road, almost nothing could be seen of these estates. They were hidden behind high walls that were themselves obscured by lush vines and other greenery. We came to a gate in one of the walls. It opened to allow the litter to pass through. I never saw a guard, though there must have been several. Cleopatra, if not Caesar, would insist on stringent security. The Queen had managed to eliminate most, but not all, of her close relatives. As long as any of them remained alive, there was always a chance they might make an attempt on her life, or that of Caesarion. That was the way of the Ptolemies. I saw the house and its many terraces only in glimpses, through breaks in the greenery. We came to a stop. Mito and I stepped from the litter into a garden with a view of the sun-spangled river. It was the same formerly laid-out garden where I had visited Cleopatra before, with manicured shrubs, gravel paths, and carefully pruned rose bushes not yet in bloom. Tucked amid the shrubbery were exquisite pieces of Greek statuary. I recognized many, such as the young boy absorbed in pulling a thorn from his foot. But at least two of the sculptures were new to me, one of winged Cupid playing with a lioness, and another, quite large, of two centaurs making off with two captured nymphs. This piece was so stunning I had to stop and stare at it. "Remarkable, isn't it?" I knew the voice, but was still a bit startled to turn and face Caesar. He was dressed as if for some formal occasion in the purple robes that he alone was allowed to wear. "Dictator," I said. I almost bowed my head, as one is expected to do for royalty, but stifled the reflex. "Gordianus, welcome, and thank you, Mito, for bringing your father so promptly."
"We were a bit slow getting across the forum," said Mito.
"No matter. I saw you gazing at the centaurs and nymphs. Truly a remarkable piece. It creates a tremendous tension in the viewer, I think, whether he realizes it or not. One smiles, seeing the joyous lechery of the grinning centaurs, and then one quails, seeing the sheer terror on the sweet faces of the nymphs. I feel that tension between the power of lust and the love of innocence each time I look at it. By Arcesilaus, as I'm sure you can tell, you with your fine eye for details, Gordianus."
"Yes, I noticed his stamp on one of the centaur's hooves."
"Ever since Arcesilaus did such an outstanding job sculpting the goddess for my new temple of Venus, I've been collecting his work. I've just about filled the garden. Calpurnia complains that if I buy any more, we'll have to purchase a whole new estate to make room for them. Ah, well, I have no more time for such concerns. Though, inevitably, in my coming travels, I'll discover many works of art that I simply must bring back, so that I can share them with the people of Rome, of course."
"Of course."
A cloud obscured the sun. Caesar looked up, then at the Tiber, no longer lit with sparkles like hammered silver, but dull grey, the colour of lead.
I thought we might talk here in the garden, but without sunshine it's a bit chilly, don't you think? Follow me. I'll conduct you across Little Egypt and into the house. If the Queen will permit us passage, that is. He flashed a knowing smile at Mito. Caesar led us through the garden. Each area was separated from the others by hedges, as rooms are separated by walls. There were yet more sculptural marvels, but Caesar's brisk pace allowed me only passing glances. We arrived at length in a section of the garden with a shallow pond at the centre, hedged all around by nodding stalks of papyrus. The pond was strewn with lily pads with bright purple flowers. Dominating the garden was a statue of Isis in one corner. The goddess was shown as the mother of Horus. She was seated, wearing a long dress that left bare her breasts, one of which she held in her hand, offering it to the suckling child on her lap. On her head was a nemes, the striped headdress worn by pharaohs, and, surmounting that, reaching high in the air, was a crown of the Hathor type, a solar disk, embraced by two upright cow horns and circled by a rearing cobra. The statue was of marble and brightly painted. The image of Isis in the heart of Caesar's estate was all the more striking because her worship in Rome, always controversial, had been banned by the Senate before the outbreak of the Civil War, and her temple in the city had been demolished. So completely was I absorbed by the statue of Isis that only when I heard the squeal of a child did I realize the garden was occupied. I turned to see Cleopatra seated on a wooden bench in the opposite corner, attended by a pair of handmaidens. She wore a gown of pleated linen. Her dark hair was pulled back into a bun. She wore a necklace and bracelets made of silver and adorned with jewels of smoky topaz and black chalcedony. "It!" cried the little boy as he rushed towards Caesar. He was twice as old as when I had last seen him in this garden, and almost twice as big, but still a bit small for a four-year-old, I thought. Perhaps it was his parents who had taught him to use an Egyptian word for father, it, instead of the Latin or Greek, as if this kept the relationship at some unofficial level, especially here in Rome, where the idea that an Egyptian prince might be heir to Caesar's throne was so loathsome to the citizens of the Republic. "Caesarion," said Caesar, scooping the boy up in his arms, then loudly groaning as men of his age do when picking up a small child. He swung the boy about, then set him on the ground. One of the handmaidens quickly took Caesarion's hand and led the child to one side. "Permission to pass through Little Egypt, Your Majesty," said Caesar, casting an arch glance at the Queen.
"Permission granted," she said, and from the playful look on her face I thought she might spring up and give him a kiss. Perhaps she would have, had not a visitor been present. She turned her eyes to me and held my gaze until, almost against my will, I made the requisite nod of obeisance. She was a visiting head of state, and I a Roman citizen of equestrian status. It seemed only proper.
"I remember you," Gordianus called Finder.
The Queen gave me a look, almost as bewitching as the one she had cast at Caesar. Cleopatra was not a great beauty. If statues of Venus were the standard, her nose and chin were too prominent, almost manly, but she exuded a charm that was impossible to deny.
This charm seemed only stronger now that she was in her middle twenties, with a voluptuous figure shown to great advantage by the moss-coloured linen gown that hugged her snugly in all the right places. "And I remember you, Your Majesty." She laughed, as if I had said something quite absurd. Could anyone meet Cleopatra and forget the experience?
"Little Egypt," I said, mostly to myself.
I gazed around me, suddenly realizing that it was quite impossible for papyri to be flourishing and lily pads to be blooming in Rome in the month of Martius. I touched one of the papyri stalks and realized it was made of wood, carved and painted to look like the Egyptian plant. Now that I looked more closely, I saw that the lily pads were also replicas, as were most of the other Nilotic specimens in this Egyptian garden. Caesar saw the look on my face and laughed.
"To make the queen feel at home during her stay, I had this garden made for her," he explained. "But I think the thing she likes best is the one she brought herself, this splendid statue of Isis, a gift to the people of Rome."
"And I thank you, Caesar, for creating this space so congenial to the goddess, though I hope to see her officially installed in a newly dedicated temple, if not during this visit, then the next time I come to Rome."
She turned her gaze to me.
"Caesar tells me that the people of the city never stopped loving the goddess, despite the opposition of some of your senators. With a new temple, the Roman people will benefit greatly from the blessings she will bestow."
"Between Caesar's wish to share great art with the people and your desire to reacquaint us with Isis, we Romans are very fortunate," I said. This elicited a small grimace of disapproval from Mito, but neither the dictator nor the queen perceived any irony in my words. Indeed, Caesar was pleased.
"Beautifully stated, Gordianus. I would almost think that Mito inherited his gift for words from you, never mind that he's adopted."
"Speaking of gifts," said Cleopatra,
"Harmonius."
At her summons, a man appeared from a break in the false papyri, dressed as I had seen palace officials in Alexandria, in a long linen gown with a broad leather belt. Behind him, wearing a metal collar and led on a tether, as if he were some exotic beast, was a young man of very dark complexion, naked except for a scrap of cloth around his loins. The slave was a skinny fellow with a plain face, and there were curious scars, like ornamental markings on his arms and chest, difficult to make out against his dark skin. Since he appeared neither especially beautiful nor strong, it was hard to see what made him a suitable gift, especially for a man who already possessed virtually everything a man could own. Perhaps he was a singer, I thought, or an acrobat. But his talent was of another sort.
"I asked and was told you don't own one of these," said Cleopatra. "I thought he might be useful to you in your travels, or even here in Rome."
"What is the fellow?" Caesar looked at the slave and cocked his head. "Those scars look familiar. Wavy lines, they're snakes," said Mito. "Or symbols that stand for snakes. Don't you remember? We saw such scars on a local tribe when we cornered Cato's forces in Africa."
"Ah, yes," Caesar said, then recited a line of poetry. "As a Punic Silas by touch charms a sleep-inducing asp."
"Very apt," said Mito.
The quotation was unknown to me.
Cleopatra laughed, and her son, seeing her delight, likewise laughed.
"I own a few of these fellows," she said, "but I am told this one is the best."
"The best at what?" I asked.
"The Psylli are snake handlers," said Mito.
"Oh, they are much more than that," said Cleopatra. "They're immune to snake bites. In fact, if a snake bites a Psyllus, it's the snake that dies. But more than that, the most talented of them, like this fellow, can suck the venom from a snake bite and tell exactly what sort of serpent it came from and what sort of remedy may cure it. They practice a sort of magic that gives relief from other poisons as well. A taster can keep you from eating poison in the first place, but a Psyllus can save you afterward."
"What a thoughtful gift," said Caesar. "If you're sure you can spare the fellow..."
"Of course. I have my own Psyllus here in Rome. I never travel without one. Nor should you, Caesar."
Harmonius bowed deeply, then led the Psyllus away. "My gratitude again, Your Majesty," said Caesar. "Time spent with you is always a pleasure. But now I must confer with this citizen." He nodded in my direction. "Will you excuse us, Your Majesties?" By using the plural, he included the little prince, at whom he winked.
"You are excused," said Cleopatra, giving him that look again.
Caesar seemed trapped by it for a moment. Then, with a blink and a shiver, he broke from her gaze and led us toward the house.
Chapter 7. We ascended a series of steps that ended at a wide terrace with a view of the gardens below and the Tiber in the distance. Off the terrace, heated by burning braziers, was a dining room with couches pulled into a square to face each other. Caesar indicated that I should take one and Mito another. He reclined on one elbow on the couch between us, which faced the terrace. The couches were upholstered with blue fabric, except for Caesar's, which was purple, like his robe, and bordered with gold embroidery. Even his dining couch had been made to resemble a throne.
"Are you hungry, Gordianus?" he said. "Of course you are. You've been to Egypt and back this morning." I didn't think I was hungry until I smelled the delicacies making their way toward us on silver platters, carried by a trio of young male slaves. Bits of tender white fish and dried figs had been glazed with olive oil and honey and roasted on skewers. Wine was also offered, mixed with cold spring water and sweetened with dollops of honey. Presumably, it had all been tasted already for Caesar's protection. Or had he dispensed with that precaution, just as he had given up his Spanish bodyguards? As we drank and ate and commented on the food, I took a closer look at Caesar. Despite his ebullient mood, it seemed to me that he appeared a bit thin and haggard, especially for a man about to set out on an expedition to the far side of the world.
"Remind me, Mito, that I must bring a gift for Cleopatra the next time I visit," said Caesar. "What do you think, a pair of gladiators, perhaps? I own so many, and they're something of a novelty in Egypt.
I'm sure the Queen would find some use for them," said Mito.
Turning to me, Caesar explained, "The Queen and I always exchange gifts or perform some other ceremonial act of state when I come to the garden villa. That way,
No one can say that I visit the Queen for any reason other than in my role as dictator, conducting the business of the Senate and people of Rome. As for the gifts themselves, sometimes we swap them back and forth. The Queen knows I'm fond of gladiators, and with all the intrigue that surrounds her, Cleopatra surely has more need of that poison detector than I do. Such intrigues do not surround the dictator, I said. Interesting that you should ask, said Caesar. What do you think, Gordianus? Is there some danger hanging over me? I should like to have said, what a coincidence. Your old friend and enemy Cicero was just asking me that same question. Instead, I said, are you worried about the omen delivered by Spurinna a month ago? Not quite a month has passed since then, said Caesar. But no, Spurinna's divination is not on my mind. I think you know that I give no credit to such things. Concrete information is another matter. As long as I have you here, I'll ask you outright, have you any knowledge of any intended threat to my person? The question was framed in such a way as to imply that he had actually summoned me for some other purpose, and was asking only to take advantage of my presence. I should like to have asked him outright to tell me the reason I was there, but it would have been impertinent for a citizen to answer a direct question from the dictator with another question. No, Caesar, I have no knowledge whatsoever of any plot to do you harm. But my value as a source of such intelligence is very small. It was different once upon a time, perhaps. But nowadays I'm like the sleeper in the Etruscan fable, who dozes through one calamity after another, and wakes only after all the trouble is over. Oh, I think you underestimate yourself, Finder, said Caesar. He's right, Papa, said Mito. You always know more than you give yourself credit for. In any case, should you think of some bit of hearsay you've forgotten, or come by some useful information, if you would convey the details to me as quickly as possible, I would be grateful, as would the Senate and people of Rome, and my wife. Your wife, Caesar? He flashed a crooked smile. To be honest, Calpurnia suggested that I should seek you out expressly for this purpose. It is the way of wives to wait and to worry, as Ennius says. And my wife worries more than most. For some reason, she has a great deal of faith in you. Because she hired me herself a couple of years ago behind your back, I thought, and my efforts on that occasion saved your life, a fact that Calpurnia made me vow never to reveal to you. Now, she was sending Caesar to me directly. Was the threat this time as real as it had been before, or just the conjecture of a worried wife and an overly zealous haruspex? Keep your ears to the ground, Caesar went on. Perhaps you might actively seek out such information, using whatever channels are available to you. Make a few discreet inquiries in that establishment you frequent. Establishment? The Salacious Tavern, I mean. How in Hades did Caesar know where I spent my idle hours? Not from Mito, who only an hour earlier had been informed about my drinking habits by Bethesda and Diana. Who had been talking about me behind my back? Was Caesar actually bothering to spy on me? See if any of your drinking companions have any thoughts on the matter. My drinking companions? I had an image of old greybeards like myself, drunk on wine, singing bawdy songs and pinching barmaids, and was quite sure I didn't fit the description. The Salacious Tavern these days was a quiet, sad place, where many of the patrons drank alone,
not the thriving den of vice it had been in its heyday, when the poet, Catullus, and his circle frequented the tavern. I hardly think of Caesar. Nonetheless, do this favour for me. His tone put an end to the discussion. Of course, Caesar. In fact, it occurs to me that you might drop in on certain men discreetly. Find some pretense for your visit. You know how to do that sort of thing. And while you're there, ask a subtle question or two, and keep your eyes and ears open for any bit of useful information. Use that power of yours to draw the truth out of men, even when they try to hide it from you. I see the ambivalent look on your face, finder. But don't you understand? It's that very attitude of yours, your doggedly diffident approach to politics and matters of state, that makes you the perfect hound for catching the hare. Men known to be loyal to me, like your son, are useless for ferreting out such secrets. No enemy would confide in them, and men not so loyal to me, well, those are the ones I'm worried about. I'll make up a short list of the men I'd like you to visit, and in a few days you can convey your impressions to me. But Caesar, I said, didn't every senator take an oath to protect you with his own life, if necessary? All the senators who survived the war, whatever side they fought for, took the oath, did they not? And all those new senators you've appointed have done so as well. True. The oath must be taken before the Senate on the day a new man wears his senatorial toga in public for the first time, as you will soon discover. His last words somehow escaped my attention, nor did I take much notice of the smile that appeared on Mito's face. Caesar also smiled. What does Parthenia say? A spoken oath is only air passing the lips. True loyalty need never be spoken aloud. Well then, I'll make sure that list of names is in your hand before you leave. The word list sent a chill through me. In my experience, any time a dictator had made a list, heads ended up on stakes, never mind Caesar's much-vaunted propensity for mercy. I sighed. How had it come about that in a matter of hours both Cicero and Caesar had drawn me into conducting an investigation for which I had no appetite whatsoever? If only Eco hadn't moved down to the cup, I would have passed the burden to him. Oh, and in the unlikely event that you should cross paths with Calpurnia, say absolutely nothing about this matter. She worries enough as it is. First you ask me to discover secrets, now you ask me to keep one. I shook my head, but I understood Caesar's concern. Spouses sometimes felt compelled to protect one another from the ugly parts of life. I could hardly refuse a commission from the dictator. A happy thought occurred to me. Surely I would report anything I should discover, significant or not, to Mito, and so I would have more precious chances to see my son before he left Rome. A final course was served of mushroom caps stewed in vinegar to cleanse the palate. Our cups were filled again with wine and spring water. Caesar looked bemused. Let me ask you something, finder. Because you're older than I, and there aren't many such men left alive in Rome. Thanks to you, I thought. Caesar gave me a sharp look. Was my face so easy for him to read? He went on. At least, there aren't many older men left whose opinion I would ask. Tell me, have you yet experienced in your long life a moment when you thought, this is it? This is the apex, the zenith. I have arrived. After this, everything else will be downhill.
Caesar paused for a moment, more to compose his thoughts than to await a reply.